Hello there, this is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club of Australia, with the monthly news broadcast for members and friends of the club for November 2025. This month, instead of the usual broadcast, we will offer an historical broadcast from years past. The usual news and information will be broadcast next month. I'm Andrew, the VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. I have broadcast files going back as far as 2001. Many of the older files aren't the greatest as far as technical quality goes, archived in either Real Audio or Windows Media Audio format. These produced a smaller file size back in the days when the leading edge technology was dial-up internet. Remember that? This month we have an original broadcast from March 2003. Details on when to hear these news and information broadcasts are available at the club website, www.raotc.org.au. The VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, 2-meter repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you miss the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email, raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's broadcast.
Hi there, this is Alan Doble, BK3AMD and Associated Relay Stations, as BK3OTN for the Radio Amateur Alzheimer's Club. We begin today's transmission with a message from our president, Bill Roper, BK3BR, and here is what Bill has to say.
Hi there. As promised in last month's broadcast, here is a brief report on the mid-February meeting of the RAOTC Committee of Management. All members of the committee, with the exception of Bruce Bathol's VK3UV, who was away assisting with the Wisin involvement in fighting bushfires, attended this first meeting of 2003. As the first order of business, Ron Cook, VK3AFW, and Jim Gordon, VK3ZKK, were elected, and welcome to membership of the RAOTCA Incorporated Committee of Management. Items of business discussed included the club's finances. Arthur, VK3VQ, tabled the financial statements for the current financial year to the 31st of December 2002 and advised that, in view of the satisfactory state of the club's finances as shown in the accounts, there is no reason to increase any of the current fees at the present time. Of course, this can be reviewed at any time if any factor comes up to alter the situation. However, at present, the club has adequate reserves to cover any foreseeable problems, at least in the short term. Some members have asked if alternate methods of paying the annual subs, other than cheque or cash or postal order, could be introduced. However, in view of the small amounts involved, it was eventually decided it would not be practical because of the additional cost to the club. The committee also reviewed the club's insurance cover. Late last year, the club secured a very suitable public liability cover by working with the WIA New South Wales division. For the present, the committee decided that this insurance cover is quite adequate and that no further action is necessary. Ron Fisher, VK3OM, made mention that volunteers to relay the monthly RAOTC news and information sessions were becoming very difficult to obtain. He asked all members of the committee to see if they could recruit any suitable amateurs to assist. A new club logo, needed because of the change of the club name due to incorporation and designed by the president, was tabled and approved. Members will see this new logo on the front cover of the next issue of OTN Magazine. The production and publishing of OTN Magazine was discussed. The present publishing dates of March and September are to continue, but trying to tie it in with the dates of the Victorian luncheons does raise some problems. In the past, it was considered desirable that the magazine be ready to mail out to members early in the months of March and September, as this meant some saving in postage by having it available to be given out at the luncheons. However, this procedure also means that a further sorting is needed after the print post sort, which can delay the bulk posting. Therefore, it was decided to leave it for decision at the time of each issue. Should the RAOTCA Incorporated have its own web page? In theory, yes, but how much would it cost, etc.? This matter was left in the hands of the President to look into regarding costs and who would be responsible for setting up the web page and maintaining it. Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, advised he would be away from home from the 5th of June until the 5th of July this year, and it was not practicable to readdress RAOTC letters in that period. However, Arthur felt there would not be any real volume of correspondence in that period to worry about. The meeting decided to advise members to contact the President if any matter was considered urgent during that period. Arthur also advised that another member of the committee was needed to sign checks if required, as we lost two committee members last year who were available to do this. The President was nominated by the committee to act in this case, and steps to register him as a signatory are to be taken. If any member requires a copy of the minutes of this February Committee of Management meeting, a copy will be sent by email only on receipt of a request to the club's new email address of, all in lowercase letters of course, raotc@optusnet.com.au. Also, until such time as a web page is up and running, a real audio file of each monthly RAOTC news and information broadcast will be emailed to members on receipt of a request to the club's email address, which once again is raotc@optusnet.com.au. Until next month, have a great time with this wonderful hobby of ours, amateur radio. 73 from Bill Roper, VK3BR, President.
Thank you, Bill. Stand by just a moment. Right, here we go. That was a very interesting message from Bill, and some things you may well have made a note of. This is VK3OTN. Here in Melbourne, we'll meet for our usual very enjoyable three-course luncheon on Tuesday, March the 11th. It will be at our usual place, the Bentley Club, and the guest speaker for a very interesting talk will be Warrant Officer Chris Tubman, a staff member of the Australian Defence Forces School of Signals at Simpson Barracks, Watsonia. His subject will be Modern Army Communications. The charge for lunch will remain unchanged at $27.50, including refreshments, as on the past three occasions. We sit down to lunch at 1 p.m. sharp. The room will be open from 12 noon. The Bentley Club, situated in Yawler Street, Bentley, that's spelled Y-A-W-L-A, Yawler Street, and members will have received booking forms, and you're requested to return them to the Secretary Arthur Evans, VK3VQ, as soon as possible. We invite listeners from other clubs to attend this interesting talk, but please note, firm bookings must be made with Arthur Evans not later than Thursday, March the 6th. Arthur is QTHR and his phone number is 95984262. Repeat, 95984262. The RAAF Signals and Radar Association of South Australia, which includes many of our members, will hold their annual Anzac Day reunion on Tuesday, April the 15th at the Marion Hotel in Mitchell Park at 12 noon for a lunch at 12:30. booking should be made by the April the 12th for Jack Townsend, VK5HT, Ray Dean 5RK, or Ron Coat VK5RB. And in Western Australia, our friends in VK6 will have their usual convivial lunch at the Bayside Tavern tomorrow week, Tuesday, March the 11th, and a good attendance is expected. Pity some of us over here in the eastern states can't get there to join you fellas. And this is VK3OTN for the Radio Emerald Timers Club. Today we welcome to full membership Barry Burns, VK6ADI, who becomes member number 1273, and Graham Mann, VK3JGM, who becomes full life member number 1274. Welcome, Barry and Graham. Graham's the son of the late Bruce Mann, VK3BN, whose hefty signal from a massive antenna farm made his name well known not only in Australia but all over the world. This is VK3OTN. Last month we had an interesting item from Wesley Phillips, who had the call signs VK3EZ pre-war and VK3YN for a while post-war. Wesley also held a first-class commercial operator certificate from July 1959, and was an officer of the Forest Commission Victoria from 1964 to 1979, Wesley writes. In 1964, all radio equipment operated by the Forest Commission and the Country Fire Authority was situated in the radio frequency band of 2 to 3 megahertz. It was heavy, inefficient, and used fragile vacuum tubes and vibrator power supplies, and probably worst of all, required a large base station antenna which, unless constructed in a vertical configuration, were very directional in propagation. These types of base station antennae also had a high angle of radiation, which meant that very often a mobile at a distance of 10 kilometers could not receive signals from base, but the base station was more often than not delivering strong signals to points well over 200 kilometers distance. This applied to both vertical and horizontal antennae, although vertical antennae radiated an omnidirectional signal. The equipment also had the additional extreme limitation of being amplitude modulated, and its impulse noises in the spectrum are also AM. Static from lightning, machinery, ignition systems, etc., played havoc, and particularly at lightning strike times when communications were critical. During my long association in a regulatory role with the type of communications used by Forest Commission, I was very aware that radical changes had to be made eventually, and when I was appointed to the position of Assistant Communications Officer, I set about planning this only to be met with open objection by the communications officer. I was also given a strict mandate by Mr. Gill to produce a radical new portable radio to be known as the FP1, that's Forest Phone 1. I found a page here. And our friend goes on. Somewhere about 1964, I was appointed to the position of Communications Officer of the Forest Commission of Victoria. At this time, forest communications were not crash hot. When I saw what faced me, I was somewhat dismayed. Excuse me. Crude base antennas with single wire 600 amp feed, folded sometimes to make them fit in. Portable radios with dry batteries. Mobile radios with helical antennas that at least 6 feet long worked against every low bow. Base radios that were not even crystal locked to base frequency. Luckily, the Chief Fire Protection Officer, which at that time was Ted Gill, agreed with me that the system was in a mess, but I was aghast when he directed me to put all my resources into the development of portable transceiver for operation in the 2 to 5 MHz band, and for this unit to be transistor equipped. I replied that he was not asking me for a development, rather an invention, as no one had yet been able to produce large amounts of RF power from a transistor without puncturing the transistor junction. We urgently imported a couple of units from the USA through a local agent, which claimed to produce an output of 5 watts. Test results, they both blew finals immediately, and the antennas looked like being mismatched. a fat lot of good for use of untrained foresters. I was satisfied that the high RF voltages developed by open-wound high-cube tank coils would always be a problem, and AWA said that research was ongoing all over the world to solve this. Then I read a French technical journal and a ferrite toroid had been developed, capable of operating into high frequencies, and I was able to obtain one of the first to arrive. This was wound with about 20 turns of 16-gauge wire across a mica compression capacitor, resonated in the region I wanted, and glory be, I eventually got 15 watts out of the thing, with the final pair of transistors happy as could be. You couldn't blow them. AWA had just released their Tenor Radio 60B using vacuum finals also. It was equipped with a transistorized receiver module covering the band I wanted. I inveigled a couple of these and quickly had a prototype operating, powered by one of Yaesu's big little 12-volt gel batteries, and it provided completely reliable minimum of 10 to 12 watts, which allowed it to be a viable proposition, installed as a mobile which could be quickly detached and used as a portable with a folding helical antenna. AWA came to the party for the manufacture of 350 units and mentioned that, to their knowledge, we had the first, the world first. We named them the Forest Phone FP1, and very faithful service they gave. However, I did not agree with the use of these frequencies for our requirement, and eventually converted the whole system to low-band VHF FM with UHF-controlled repeaters. I retired at 60 years and did take out the course on BK3YN for a time, but commercial equipment was boring, so I gave it in. And Wesley says, I'm now 83 years of age and my present hobby is ultralight aircraft. I've just completed the building of a J-Guru 3300. And just further to that story, about the forest phone, we have a copy of a letter from AWA to the Forestry Commissioner in Victoria dated the 27th of July 1965. It reads as follows. Thank you for the opportunity to assist the prototype all-transistor HF transceiver with a view to submitting a proposal for its manufacture. From our preliminary tests of this unit, we found the development work undertaken by your officer, Mr. Philpott, is considerably advanced and of consequence minimizes the engineering required to ensure production of equipment at our factory. With these aspects in mind, we consider it would be to Commission's advantage if Mr. Philpott was able to spend 3 or 4 days with our project engineer, Mr. F. Holliday, at our works at 554 Parramatta Road, Ashfield, to discuss both the design and general concept of the unit. Following Mr. Philpott's visit to our Ashfield plant, we'll submit a proposal for the manufacture of the unit for consideration by the Commission. So there's an interesting bit of history of development of radios here in Victoria. This is VK3ATN, VK3AMD and Associated Relay Stations. And here's an item provided by Ray Peterson, VK6PW. It's about the Japanese midget submarines and their motherships, the I-class submarines. The article comes from the Engineers Australia Journal for September 2002, and is written by Ian McFarlane, a railway engineer and former intelligence officer. His sources are acknowledged as the RAN Official History in the well-known James series of books. I'm omitting a few paragraphs, but we will publish the whole story in a future issue of ATN. This is VK3ATN, and this account goes as follows. The attack on Sydney was mounted from a flotilla of 5 mother submarines of the Imperial Japanese Navy's B-1, B-2 and B-3 classes under the command of a Captain Hankyu Sasaki of 1937-40 concept and generally termed I-belts. They were unusually large long-range patrol subs intended to operate not only in the traditional lone wolf role but if desired as a strike flotilla. The formidable fleet Admiral Yamamoto of Pearl Harbor fame was a protagonist of this concept, and as a result, the I-boats had unusual mixes of armaments. I-21 of the B-1 class was typical, and among the 1942 Sydney ships, a very large sub for her time, she was 109 meters long, 9.3 inches metres beam and 5.2 metres draft, displacing some 2,600 tonnes surface and 3,700 tonnes when dived. This was about twice that of contemporary US Navy Gato class, which were patrolling similar Pacific distances, and three times that of the German Type IX U-boats, creating mayhem in the Atlantic. I-21 had two diesels totaling 4,625 kilowatts, giving it a speed of 23.5 knots on the surface, and two electric motors totaling 1,500 kilowatts, giving about 8 knots when dived to a maximum depth of 100 meters. The I-boat ranges were up to 38,000 kilometers on the surface and 32 hours endurance at 5 kilometers an hour when submerged. Some I-boats had a primitive form of radar by late 1941. I-21 had port of the sail, a short watertight cylindrical aircraft hangar from which a long fixed catapult runway rose along the forward casing almost to the bows. A small one-man aircraft had folding wings and a range of 3 hours and 150 kilometers an hour. It had a radio for gunnery spotting. Flying operations were somewhat fair weather, as the aircraft had to be powered up and catapulted off, with the submarine also powering at maximum speed into the wind and perhaps a head sea, all on an open deck only some 2 meters above the waterline. Little aeroplane landed in the open oceans, recovered by a derrick. Captain Suzuki, Sydney Flotilla, and their mix of exotic weaponry were I-21 with aircraft, I-22 with a midget, and 21, I-24 a midget, as determined by the RAN, I-27 a midget, number 14, and I-29 aircraft, believed unserviceable on the 30th of May. 10 days earlier, on Wednesday the 20th of May, I-29's aircraft overflew Sydney Harbour, completely undetected, even though Sydney had air defence radar at this time. Then at 3 o'clock on Saturday morning, the 30th of May, Lieutenant Sosomi Ito was catapulted off I-21, some 64 kilometres northeast of North Head. He too overflew Sydney, detected but wrongly identified by the US crews of Chicago as a Curtiss seaplane, and likewise unmolested. But when landing in rough water, his little floatplane capsized and sank. He survived the crash and the war. On the basis of his report of capital ships in the harbour, Sasaki ordered preparation and release of the three midgets from I-22, 24 and 27 at dusk. The next day, Sunday the 31st of May, some 11 kilometres off the heads, navigation lights were obligingly burning, and the gate and boom defence net from Greenpoint to George's Head was open not only for naval and steamer traffic, but a 30-minute service of Manly ferries. Midget 14 crossed the detector loop at 20 hours 14 and got caught in the net. The alarm was not given up until 22:27, and Midget 14 was finally destroyed at 22:35. Midget 21 was attacked by HMAS Yandra between the heads at 23:07, but survived. And with Midget Ace, he got through the net gate, probably in the wake of either the cargo steamer Wyandjeri inbound from the north coast or a Manly ferry. At 22:50, Chicago spotted the A-4 periscope some 500 metres away. They fired two torpedoes from near Bradley's Head. They missed Chicago, but exploded under the old wooden barracks ferry SS Cuttable at Garden Island, killing 21 RAN sailors. RAN small craft pinned down Midget 21. Its crew destroyed the boat and themselves, but the daringly handled Midget A escaped through the net. This is all part of a talk, an article about this in the Engineers Journal, and this is VK3OGN. The submarine was never seen again, as the operation had called for sailing some 55 kilometres from launch to return to another ships and involved full power manoeuvring to avoid RAN attackers. My guess is that her batteries probably died somewhere between the heads and the five I-boats waiting off Newport and Palm Beach, and the crew destroyed the ship and themselves. K-10 Midget Hulk synthesized from the T-Rex is on display at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra, and abalone fishermen are supposed to have found, sunk on the seabed off the far south coast of New South Wales, the wreck of an I-boat. It may be the boat bombed by RAAF Hudson off Cobo Island on 4th of June, 42. Within the hours of the Battle of Sydney Harbour on the 1st of June, two midgets, the Mai 10 and 16 and 20, attacked RN ships anchored at Vigo Sierras in Madagascar, sinking a 7,000-ton tanker and damaging the battleship HMS Ramillies. And on the 8th of June, this I-21 shelled Newcastle and I-24 shelled Sydney, in both cases ineffectually. But seven merchant ships were sunk and another five attacked off the New South Wales coast around this time. In mid-43, the I-boats, including I-21, returned, sinking 11 ships on the New South Wales coast and damaging three. On the 14th of May, the Australian hospital ship Central was torpedoed off Brisbane, probably by I-178, with a loss of 269 lives. Nobody admitted this war crime. So while consuming twice the naval resources of a US Gato boat, an I-boat could torpedo an unarmed merchant ship. Big deal. Strategically, however, their record was poor, and of 29 O-boats in these three classes, only two survived the war. It seems they were too big, too complicated, and too vulnerable for their time. And that's the end of that article. Thank you, Ray Peterson, for sending it along. Newer members of our club may not realise that in the March 94 and September 99 issues of our magazine ATN, we published for the first time in the world a lot of information about the very interesting and effective radio transceivers installed in the Midget Sub. And this information was obtained from the Australian Archives in Melbourne. This is PK3OTN for the Radio and for the Old Timers Club. Radio telescopes. Radio magazines have been reporting the death in Tasmania of last year of the man who was credited with being the first man to design and build a radio telescope. This was in his home country of America. His later years were spent in Tasmania, where he built a large one, which has apparently fallen into disrepair. Articles written by Grant Weaver appear in many technical publications over the years. Our own radio telescope at Parkes in New South Wales is world famous for its performance. And thinking about these things reminds me that when the Parkes radio telescope had been designed and was being built, the man who was to be its director, Taffy Dunn, gave a talk to the Institute of Radio Engineers at the Radio Department Theatre at the RMIT in Swanson Street. I've always remembered his words when talking about its expected performance, when he said, and I quote, "We might be able to see to the edge of the universe," unquote. Incidentally, you may not know that Taffy Bowen, who was a pioneer of radio research in Britain, was the man who carried the top secret newly developed magnetron to the USA, together with all the design and performance information. His task was to enable the USA to gear up its vast industrial capacity to manufacture the magnetron on a much greater scale than Britain could manage. The Americans were totally astonished at the sample's performance, but there's one thing that took a lot of explaining. The sample had seven cavities. The drawing showed eight. Bowen stayed on in the USA for, I think, several months until quantity production was up and running. Back to radio telescopes. The July 1975 issue of a magazine that I've now mislaid carried an article and photographs about what was claimed to be the largest unit in the world, operated by America and located in Arecibo in Puerto Rico. We've all heard about it over the years. It's 3.05-meter diameter reflector in a mountain valley. The article includes a statement that will give you something to think about. It says, and I quote, "One of the most dramatic improvements to the telescope has been the addition of a powerful new radar transmitter. This new transmitter has an output of 450 kilowatts, and when concentrated into a narrow beam by the reflector, has an effective radiated power 100 times greater than the total electric power production of all the generating plants in the world." Unquote. You might like to get out your slide rule or calculator and check that calculation. I'd be interested in your findings. This is VK3AMD and VK3OTN with associated relay stations. The story that follows might well be true, but I wasn't there and so can't vouch for it. In wartime Vietnam, an Australian soldier was very much in love with his wife, whose name was Glenda. So much so, in fact, he had her name tattooed on his penis, where it normally showed only as the first and last letters, G and A. One time on the way from the front on RMR leave, he entered a nearby toilet to have what in colloquial terms is called a pee. As he stood there, he glanced sideways and intrigued to find that the tall, dark GI Joe alongside had the same two letters showing in a similar place to his own. As they both turned to walk away, the Aussie plucked up his courage and told the American he'd inadvertently seen the GNA letters, which in his case were beginning and end of his dear wife's name, Glenda, and wondered if, by some strange coincidence, they formed part of the same name. "That's okay, Aussie, mate," said the GI. "When I get excited, mine spells out good old Alabama. But on that happy note, I'll leave you for our next very meeting, which my calendar says will be April Fool's Day." This is Alan Global, VK3AMD, and associated relay stations is VK3OTN, the official call sign of the Radio Amateur Old-Timers Club Australia, Incorporated. We're about to conclude our news and information transmission for this month and hope our listeners have found it interesting. The next monthly news and information transmission will be on air on Monday, April the 1st. Repeat, Monday, April the 1st, and that's not a joke. It'll be at the same times and frequencies as today, remembering that in April we will no longer be on daylight saving time here in the eastern states. The callback systems that will follow today's transmission will take two forms to enable us to understand our listening audience. The first call will be for listeners to give only their name and call sign so we know that you were listening, and that's very important. Then the callback operators will be looking for all who wish to make reports or comments, and we look forward to lots of both types of calls. Thank you for listening, and 73.
That's all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks, where callbacks are taken. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies, and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. If you have missed all or part of this broadcast, or you just want to listen to it again, it is available for download from the RAOTC website. Simply go to www.raotc.org.au. Again, the website URL is www.raotc.org.au. Sometimes the relay station is an automated broadcast, for example, a repeater, where no operator is available to take callbacks. Other times the volunteer operator suffers from very heavy local QIM, and callbacks are not always possible. Many operators need a small amount of time to switch from playing a recorded file to using a microphone. Please be mindful of this. This is VK3OTN signing clear from today's news and information session. 73 from the RAOTC broadcast team.